Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, after rumblings over the summer, as we approach the start of the school year, it's official. California is the first state in the nation mandating that school staff either get vaccinated or test regularly for COVID. Governor Newsom made that announcement yesterday, and really, there's just a lot to unpack. When this takes effect, who exactly this applies to, what are the consequences for those who refuse, and down the road, will this eventually extend to students who are eligible to receive the vaccine? Despite this tempering the anxiety many have been feeling as cases and hospitalizations rise due to the Delta variant, there is also pushback. So to help us sift through all of that, Joe Hong joins us. Joe is a journalist for Cal Matters. That's a nonprofit newsroom focusing on the biggest issues statewide. Joe has been closely following developments on K-12 education. Welcome to Insight, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
You have been closely following K-12 developments statewide. What struck you about yesterday's announcement and really the breaking news alerts that followed?
Yeah, I think what struck me is that the conversation over a vaccine or regular testing requirement for teachers, the conversation seems to have been going on before long before the announcement the governor made the announcement yesterday. You know, within the past two weeks, state employees, healthcare workers, the vaccine requirements for those folks were announced. And I think everyone was wondering, like, when is the mandate coming for teachers? But I think there was just a lot of negotiations going on during that radio silence.
Was there something significant from what you could gather that led to the announcement yesterday, you know, pulling the trigger and expanding this to school staff across the state?
I think the biggest thing is that this is going to help schools stay open for the whole school year. You know, I think distance learning was a disaster in most of the state. And yeah, state officials just want to do everything they can to make sure they can keep students in the classroom.
Well, let's get down to, you know, the nuts and bolts. Who exactly does this apply to?
So this applies to every school employee, public school employee. So that means all your paraeducators, teachers, obviously, you know, custodial staff, anyone who's regularly on campus needs to be tested once a week or submit proof of vaccination. And the mandate goes into effect today.
And essentially, so that's anyone who comes in contact with a student. So that's custodial staff and bus drivers as well.
That's right, yeah.
And you mentioned public schools. Does this expand to private schools as well?
You know what? That's frankly, I'm not super clear on that yet. We'll have to see. I need to do more reporting on that.
Yeah. I mean, this all just came out yesterday and there's just a lot to follow.
Yeah.
Universal masking is already in place in K-12 settings. I mean, what were you able to kind of learn when it came to taking requirements a step further?
So I should say that the mask mandate was controversial in some areas. You know, I spoke to superintendents in more rural school districts. These are parts of the state that tend to lean more conservative politically, and they were not too happy about that, mostly because these smaller school districts were able to reopen successfully during the school year. So they thought sort of a blanket mandate for masks was unnecessary. You know, they wanted to see students' faces. They wanted students to see each other's faces. And then in more urban areas of California, they were, you know, folks were really happy about the mask mandate. Now, yeah, taking this the mandate a step further and requiring vaccines or regular testing, I think for some folks it was a little, you know, like contradictory, because the governor, until last Friday when he gave a press conference at a school in San Bernardino, he said he was confident that masking, increased ventilation, physical distancing, that would be enough, and that a vaccine or regular testing mandate, you know, he stopped short of that. And I don't know. I don't really know how to read that. But I think for the most part, parents are pretty pleased that you know, the governor is doing everything he can to keep schools open.
Yeah, I think that's on par with everything that's been happening since 2020. You know, not everyone's going to be on the same page and have the best, you know, idea or agree on the best way to move forward. When it comes to public health experts, though, I mean, what are you hearing when it came to this new requirement for vaccine or testing?
Yeah, so public health experts have been calling for a vaccine mandate because, you know, again, they want to keep schools open. And, you know, it gets a little nuanced because during the whole pandemic, kids, especially younger kids, have been less likely to get seriously ill from COVID-19, right? But it came down to just protecting teachers and protecting everyone who's on campus. So they can, you know, minimize the risk of, you know, an outbreak or high case numbers that would require schools to shut down again. And, you know, I can't emphasize enough that sort of the havoc that distance learning has wreaked on student academics and student mental health. So the public health experts really just they're not too worried about student safety in regards to a vaccination mandate for teachers, but it all comes down to, like, you know, keeping kids in the classroom.
Yeah. And actually, I was able to just pull up an article from NPR, and it actually this mandate for vaccination or testing does actually extend to private schools as well. So we'll just continue to see how that develops. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CalMatters journalist Joe Hong about the new vaccine and COVID testing requirements for school staff across California. All right, when covering education, I mean, obviously a lot of negotiations take place behind the scenes with teachers' unions and other collective bargaining groups. What kind of negotiations took place when it came to this announcement?
You know what? Well, behind the scenes, I don't really know what the conversation was like. You know, Governor Newsom yesterday did say that the conversation has been ongoing for a while, and they were finally ready to make the announcement yesterday. But, you know, I can say at the local level, you know, before the statewide mandate dropped yesterday, you know, this was a strictly local conversation between school districts and their employees, right? Being the teachers who are, you know, represented by local teachers unions. And there was almost, there were a handful of school districts that had already called for teachers to either be vaccinated or undergo regular testing. So those negotiations were already happening on a local level. But, you know, I think the concern was, you know, with everything during the pandemic in the past 18 months, like minimizing sort of the variation across the state, keeping things equitable. And, you know, because the last thing you want is for there to be more outbreaks among teachers at some districts where other districts are doing just fine because they enacted a vaccine or testing mandate.
Have you heard of any pushback? I mean, I know the reality is this does quell some anxiety for people, but there's others who don't want to be told what to do, that they have to get vaccinated or undergo regular testing.
Yeah, I mean, just on social media, you know, you always see folks saying that this is an overreach of the government. I've talked to local teachers union presidents who personally they support this mandate, but they know that there are going to be some teachers who are really upset, are really annoyed by the testing requirement or the vaccination requirement. The challengers in the recall election, a few of them spoke out against the mandate. John Cox and Kevin Faulkner, they all seem to support vaccinations, but they say a state mandate is kind of an abuse of power on Newsom's part.
Well, I guess going forward with that, I mean, do you know of any type of consequences for someone who just refuses? Do they just effectively lose their job, or is that still being worked out? Because, I mean, obviously there are a variety of unions and collective bargaining groups that work within individual school districts.
That's so, yeah. Governor Newsom got that question yesterday, and he seemed not too worried about that. He thinks, I believe he said, the word he used was enlightened. He said, you know, educators are enlightened and they'll do the right thing. But I don't know, I'm not too sure about the specifics, but in the state education code, there are sort of like protocols for how to sort of sanction a teacher who doesn't abide by state law. So I don't believe, you know, teachers will be immediately fired, but there is a process for that.
So this takes effect officially today, but what is the deadline? I mean, it's not like everyone can just automatically submit a vaccination card or get vaccinated today. I mean, is there a deadline when this needs to take place?
I haven't heard anything about a deadline, but it does seem that, you know, folks who aren't vaccinated yet or haven't submitted their vaccination cards just need to undergo, you know, regular testing. And I will say that some teachers union leaders are saying that this mandate isn't good enough, that either you need to require all teachers to be vaccinated and you need to require all teachers, whether or not they're vaccinated, to be regularly tested because of this new Delta variant, because vaccinated folks could carry the virus. So no deadline, but I think like there will be some teachers who are vaccinated, have submitted their vaccination cards, but will regularly be tested regardless.
Looking ahead, did the governor allude to expanding this requirement to students?
Yeah, I wouldn't say he alluded, but, you know, he said the thing that, you know, no journalist wants to hear, that, you know, they're discussing the issue. We're going to take it step by step. So I think we just have to keep waiting for that next announcement.
Yeah. Well, finally, what are you focusing next on the education front? There's so many moving parts.
Yeah, so many moving parts. I think, you know, with the start of this next school year, I'm curious to see, you know, the effort to recover both academically and what educators call like social emotionally. You know, some teachers are really afraid that their districts will focus too much on the academics when really learning isn't just sort of an intellectual or neurological sort of activity. It's an emotional one. And, you know, teachers are calling for more mental health supports for their kids. So it'll be interesting to see how districts provide those services, and whether the whole student is sort of supported this new school year. And sort of the second thing I'm interested in is quarantines. You know, I think among the school districts that have started school already, you've already seen like, you know, dozens of cases at some districts within weeks, and those have led to quarantines. And sort of my next thing will be seeing like how disruptive those quarantines are and whether quarantine practices are being, you know, implemented sort of equally across the state.
Yeah. I mean, just so many threads to follow. And even though it's a step in the right or a step forward, it's so far from, you know, a school year in 2019.
Absolutely.
Joe, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Joe Hong is a journalist for CalMatters. He just getting us up to speed on the new vaccine and COVID testing requirements for school staff across the state. Up next, we're about a month to the recall election, and we'll get you up to speed on the latest with an insider's look. Plus, we get our hands a little dirty and learn about the expansion of composting across the state. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Governor Newsom recall election is just around the corner, and we're talking just a little over 4 weeks away. Mail-in ballots are en route to registered voters across the state. But despite this big decision shaping the future of California, voting may just feel like one more thing in a year that continues to prove what began in 2020 is far, far from over. I mean, not to even mention wildfires and drought plaguing the state. There are just a lot of moving parts when it comes to the gubernatorial recall election. And the direction is moving forward to September 14th, whether we're ready for it or not. So to get us up to speed on the latest, we're joined now by Nikki Lorenzo, co-host of Inside California Politics, which airs weekly statewide. Nikki is also a familiar face locally, the evening co-anchor at Fox 40. Nikki joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. Thank you for having me.
You know, Nikki, you're just so tapped into California politics. I kind of imagine you like a pinball machine bouncing around just to stay on top of how things are developing.
That's a really good analogy. There's a lot going on. And, you know, even without this recall election, you mentioned it in 2020. I mean, things just have not slowed down. And this just adds another layer to that.
Yeah. With that lens that you have, and it's so like in depth with politics across the state, let's just take a step back. I mean, did you envision we'd be here? What stands out to you about this moment?
Well, you know, coming into this recall, I think it's important for people to remember that the recall started prior to the pandemic. And you've really seen the governor's team lately sort of bring that up too. You know, his campaign side say this recall started long before the election, before the pandemic was even in front of us. And that sort of exacerbated it, and the shutdowns and of course the infamous French Laundry dinner energized the efforts, and the extension with the signatures that the recall effort was granted that really brought into play this landscape. And Republicans are really energized right now. I mean, I've talked to Ann Dunsmore with Rescue California. She's, you know, the lead fundraiser, and they're really happy with some of the polling that has come out lately. We've done two polls in the last 3 weeks, Inside California Politics, partnering with Emerson College. And, you know, it really looked like the governor, he had really high polling numbers. And any sort of Democratic consultant or lawmaker will say, okay, look to 2003, look to the last recall. Gray Davis is great polling numbers. He was so unfavorable and so not liked among both Democrats and Republicans. The electorate in California was totally different during that time. And Governor Newsom had, you know, early on in the pandemic, had some really high poll numbers. But what we saw lately over the past couple of weeks, the appetite for the recall and those against the recall is pretty much dead even. And if you look at issues too, when we broke it down more, homelessness. Voters are concerned about homelessness, and I think the governor has really done a poor job in terms of that.
Yeah. And when comparing to Governor Gray Davis's recall in 2003, you know, as you mentioned, the electorate skews heavily more Democrat, and there isn't this juggernaut celebrity challenger like, you know, Schwarzenegger. But it seems like you see holes when analysts say Governor Newsom is in a far better position than Davis's recall.
Indeed, too. And you can see in some of the messaging, too, when our poll came out, we received a statement from the campaign spokesperson who said, OK, yes, you know, we see these numbers essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, but they're really worried about turnout and Democrats being complacent because, you know, we live in a state, we have super majorities in both houses. California overwhelmingly voted for Joe Biden. We have two Democratic senators. I mean, when people think California, I mean, let's be honest, the Republican Party doesn't have a foothold here. I think it was pretty interesting. One of the candidates running in the recall, Kevin Kiley, an assemblyman out of Rockland, he says he's part of the super minority in the legislature. So that just kind of gives you an idea of how the Republican Party is viewed right now. But Democrats are worried about turnout. If you look at recall elections in the history in California, it's all about being energized. And yes, we do not have an Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that was the big debate, you know, over the last year or so. Would we see a high profile candidate jump into this race? Okay, yeah, we saw Caitlyn Jenner. She's a reality star, a former Olympian, an activist, but she hasn't really taken off. She's in our poll, she's at 7%. Then Larry Elder jumps in. Yes, he is a name among the political base. And in terms of being that talk show host, that Fox News personality. But is he enough to energize voters? I mean, that's going to be, we're going to wait and see that. But Democrats are definitely concerned about turnout. I mean, yes, every single voter is going to get a ballot. But let's be honest. I mean, I'm looking at my counter right now and I have a stack of mail that I need to go through.
I have two.
Everybody is busy in their daily lives. You know, kids are going back to school as we speak. You know, your previous guest is talking about, you know, new mandates in terms of vaccines. There is a lot to digest and unpack in our lives and understand that maybe someone doesn't see their ballot and go, is it really necessary that I do this? So you're really going to see Democrats sort of ramp this up over the next few weeks or so as people are receiving their ballots. I know a couple of people that have already received their ballots. So, you know, you're seeing the messaging from Newsom's campaign. Elizabeth Warren has been a spokesperson right now saying no on the recall, tying it to Trump Republicans. This is an effort by Trump Republicans to steal the election, to steal an election. And it's going to be interesting to see over the next couple of weeks who else comes out. You know, there have been calls, will Jerry Brown come out? You know, there is a thought that Kamala Harris, she's expected to campaign for the governor. Will she be the closer? Will we see her, you know, in the last week or so leading up to Election Day?
Yeah. Big headline this week. I mean, what you're talking about is also can be seen as an opportunity for the Republican Party, but the California GOP chose not to endorse a candidate. I mean, what's up with that?
Okay, so let's go back to the end of July. This really seemed like something that the California Republican Party Chairwoman Jessica Milan Patterson really wanted to get behind. So back at the end of July, the California Republican Party, they created a pathway for an endorsement. Candidate needed 60% support from the delegates. So at this time, you were seeing, you know, Kevin Kiley, Doug Osi, Kevin Faulkner, really sort of reaching out to the delegates saying, you know, I need your support. I was given a breakdown of how things were looking. John Cox, who ran against the governor, was the Republican candidate in 2018. It didn't look like he was going to meet the threshold. And what was interesting is he came out early and said, I don't agree with this. We shouldn't be doing this. This is the California Republican Party trying to move the goalpost. Kevin Faulkner came out and said, you know, we should unite. We really shouldn't endorse. So delegates were given two options. They can endorse a candidate or they could vote not to endorse. So their state convention was last weekend. And really in the 11th hour, you saw influential members of the California Republican Party. Harmeet Dhillon, a conservative lawyer out of the Bay Area, sent out a tweet saying, we shouldn't be doing this. This helps Gavin Newsom. We shouldn't be picking sides. We should just be coalescing around this effort because this isn't about one particular Republican. This is about Gavin Newsom and getting him out of office. So at the end of this, the party decided not to endorse. And I spoke with State Senator Scott Wilk yesterday for this weekend's episode, this Sunday's episode of Inside California Politics. And I said, you know, why all this pomp and circumstance and then nothing? You know, why did you guys decide to do this? And he said, well, it was all about giving the delegates an option. And we chose the right option. We said, no, you know, we shouldn't be picking a certain candidate. Let's look like we are unified. Any of these candidates would be better than Gavin Newsom. That is their notion. But I want to say he has come out strong and said that he is supporting Kevin Faulkner. He believes he's a moderate and has the best chance of being the governor of California.
Yeah. The governor also, I mean, we're just talking about the big announcement yesterday impacting school staff across the state. I mean, the governor is holding big press conferences statewide, but really his accessibility to journalists, you know, to ask those tough questions has arguably been difficult. I guess, what are you able to gather about the governor's strategy when it comes to the recall election?
So there was really no discussion about the recall. The governor didn't want to talk about it. He didn't even want to address it early on. He was very adamant that this is all about California and his roaring back plan and getting us on this other side of the pandemic. And they sort of just brushed it aside. That was the strategy. And a couple of weeks ago, he came out strong and, you know, was very, very adamant that this was this Republican effort. And he pointed to, you know, certain hosts on Fox News who were driving this ideology. And it's really been about him and the work in terms of my vantage point. Like you said, he does not do a lot of interviews. There aren't a lot of press events. There was an event this week in Berkeley where the governor was picking up trash because he has really honed in on homelessness, and even come out and said something along the lines of, you know, camping outside is just unacceptable, but we need to address homelessness in a compassionate way. And we were not, and I mean we, the press, we were not alerted to this until right before this event was set to happen. And your previous guest talked about, you know, some of the press conferences that he's had down in San Bernardino, and he will take a couple of questions, you know, here and there. But we have reached out to the governor's office, both, you know, on the governor's office side and also the campaign side, looking for some one-on-one time with him to talk about the recall, to get his message out. And we either get no response or, you know, we just aren't available at this time. But I know with talking to certain members of the Capitol Press Corps that there is some frustration in Sacramento that a lot of these events are not happening here, and they do not have the ability to ask him questions directly.
Yeah, especially if you're announcing something right before, especially in Berkeley. I mean, you can't, with traffic, I mean, it's not like you can just, it's not a hop, skip, and a jump over. So
you can't jump right over to the Bay Area quickly nowadays.
You know, I guess when it comes to this strategy, do you see any parallels with other campaigns?
You know, in terms of Larry Elder, yes. Larry Elder is doing... he's doing interviews, and he's a bit more successful in, or accessible rather, in terms of the press. But I will say when it comes to debates, he is not doing any debates. And his reasoning is, look, I don't think this should be all of us Republicans attacking one another. In my conversation with him, he says if he becomes the next governor of California, he would be happy to appoint some of his fellow Republicans in his administration. I asked him specifically, what would you do with Caitlyn Jenner? He said, I don't know. I'm going to think about that. But when I was talking to State Senator Wilk, he actually thought that was a bad strategy for the leading Republican. He said, yes, you know, some people may know him. He may have name ID, but as a Republican and an elected official in the state of California, I had no idea who he was. I read about him in the LA Times, and what I read in the LA Times isn't good. So he needs to get out there and defend himself more. Caitlyn Jenner has done a couple of interviews here and there. She did one with my colleague down in LA, my co-host on Inside California Politics, Frank Buckley. It was a lengthy discussion, but she is not debating either. So it seems like some of these more high profile names are sort of following suit with just getting their message out, you know, using social media, but in terms of a lot of press interviews or debating, there's no interest in that.
Right. And there are upcoming recall debates with willing challengers. I mean, the governor hasn't committed to one. It's a crowded field, as we're talking about. And you just talked about Larry Elder polling in the lead. But I mean, even with your poll, there's so many polls that are circulating right now, which really give you a glimpse and a temperature check. But what margin are we talking about when we're talking about a challenger that is in the lead poll wise?
So if you look at our Inside California Politics poll, I'll go back to the first one that we did at the end of July. It had Larry Elder, who had only been, I think when we put the poll out, he had just announced 3 days prior. And he came in at 16%. And then it was, you know, in single digits, John Cox, Kevin Faulkner, and Caitlyn Jenner, kind of trailing far behind. 2 weeks later, Larry Elder jumped up to 23%. And then you had John Cox, Kevin Kiley at this point, Caitlyn Jenner, around the 7% and 5%. But what was interesting that I saw is that Kevin Faulkner dropped 2 points at 4%. And really coming into this recall, the Republican Party and maybe even some moderate Democrats, there was this notion that he would sort of take off. He was a mayor of San Diego, two-term mayor of San Diego. The electorate in San Diego is overwhelmingly Democratic. He was sort of, you know, a moderate Republican. Yes, he voted for Trump in 2020. He didn't vote for him in 2016. You know, he touted his record as homelessness. And so I was a bit surprised with his ranking in that poll, considering he had been running for a while. He was an elected official. And you see Larry Elder at the top of this. But what's interesting about in terms of how voters feel if we get past question one, question two, who should replace the governor? We still have 40% who are undecided in our Inside California Politics poll. So you have Larry Elder at 23%, but 40% are still undecided. So this really brings up that notion that some Democrats talked about early on, whether they, you know, there was whispers in the Capitol, or you had certain prominent Democrats like former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown saying, maybe we should put a Democrat on the ballot or even talk about it just in case the governor does get recalled. Do we want to have a Republican governor in the state of California?
Yeah. And I just bringing that up, like 40% are undecided on who they would want as governor if they chose to recall Governor Newsom. I mean, so there's also this reality that, you know, to recall a governor, a majority of votes are needed. That's not the case when it comes with who is chosen to replace the governor. I mean, it's just the candidate with the most votes. It's a plurality. So even if it's far less than a majority vote. So there is this realistic scenario where the governor actually could receive more votes than any other candidate, but still be removed from office.
Exactly. And that has been a lot of discussion among Democrats in California that this, the requirements, the threshold has to change. And there have been efforts to do that. I know it's really frustrating. You know, some of our Democratic analysts that we've had on Fox 40 locally have said, this is ridiculous that this can happen, especially if you go and look back at the original language in the recall effort. It had nothing to do with the pandemic, and they just honestly feel like it's unfair. And if you go and look on the Secretary of State's website, there's an interesting breakdown. If you look back since 1913, there have been 179 recall attempts of state elected officials. So that's not just governor, but all elected officials. 11 recall efforts collected enough signatures to qualify. So that's since 1913. And of those, an official was recalled 6 times. So, of course, the big one in California is 2003, Gray Davis and Arnold Schwarzenegger. But again, things are so different. The electorate is so different. And the candidates, I mean, you had arguably the most famous person in the entire country, a movie star, running to be the governor of California.
Well, I'll just leave with this. I mean, nationally, the big news this week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's resignation. Clearly different reasons. But I mean, the fact that both he and Governor Newsom, they really bookend, you know, like the two most powerful Democratic states in the country. 2022, just around the corner. What is the signal?
Well, it's really interesting because if you think back to early on in the pandemic, Governor Cuomo and Governor Newsom were seen as very popular leaders. I mean, even I think it's safe to say, I know it's in certain areas among Democrats and even some Republicans too. I mean, Governor Cuomo was America's governor. There was even, you know, discussions of drafting him to run for president, you know, or even discussions about him as a vice presidential option. And he resigns this week, and this is all happening in the backdrop, obviously, like you said, very, very different circumstances. And let's be honest, in 2022, historically, if you look at the first midterms of after any presidential election, it is always a referendum on the administration. So it's going to be interesting to see how voters feel about what the Biden administration has accomplished over the past couple of years. And to see these two powerful praised governors in this situation, I'm not saying I am the brightest political mind. I like to talk to the brightest minds in politics and learn from them. I am never the smartest person in the room. I never want to be the smartest person in the room. But I don't think anyone would have predicted where we are if you look at the state of New York and the state of California.
Yeah. Nikki, nice chatting with you.
Always a pleasure, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
Nikki Lorenzo is the co-host of Inside California Politics and the evening co-anchor at Fox 40, just getting us up to speed on the latest in the upcoming recall election. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, more and more cities and counties are rolling out composting programs across the state. One of my best friends actually was just like elated to learn that Sacramento and Yolo counties will soon allow residents to dispose edible organic material in their home yard waste bins. I mean, she literally texted me with exclamation points. So this is all actually part of a state law that's mandating an expansion of recycling programs with the goal to reduce food waste sent to landfills by 75% by 2025. And that is quickly approaching. So that ultimately means there's going to be some resorting on our part when it comes to what goes in the garbage and the yard waste bins. So to better understand what the main focus areas are, is Cal Rice Director Rachel Maki Wagner. Rachel, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, pleasure to have you. Well, Rachel, so SB 1383, I mean, that is now in law. It was described at that time as the biggest change to trash in California in over 30 years. I mean, why?
It is. It's such an exciting opportunity for us to be a part of what needs to happen to fight climate change. California is on the verge of a really important change with 1383 implementation. We are going to be diverting 75% of our organic waste, that's your food waste and your yard waste and other organics, from landfills. And that means that we are going to be decreasing the amount of methane that is in our landfills. Methane is 84 times more potent than carbon. And when we reach our 75% goal, we will be reaching an equivalency of 1.7 million cars off the road.
Wow. That law was signed by Governor Brown back in 2016. What kind of progress has been made in the last 5 years?
Well, it's exciting. We have over 400 jurisdictions, local governments here in California, and more than 350 of them about have implemented organic waste diversion programs. So that's collection programs from restaurants and grocery stores, and well over 120 of them have also implemented residential programs. And as you mentioned, your good friend is very excited here in Sacramento. We are getting ready to do that here in the Sacramento region as well. Sacramento County, Sacramento City, Yolo County have all started the process to start those collection services here too.
Yeah, I mean, logistically though, there's just, it's a lift, you know, when you're talking about, you know, 400 jurisdictions that are tasked to handle with this. How does the state, CalRecycle, how is it helping waste collection agencies prepare for all of this?
Well, we've been working with them. As you said, this legislation passed in 2016. And we've been working with local jurisdictions from the very beginning on helping them develop model ordinances for them to adopt, tools to implement, working with them on the specific things that each region needs to do in order to have collection happen for their region. So we think that there is a lot of opportunity for partnership, and we've been doing that for many, many years. So we think that every jurisdiction in California is well primed to succeed and really help the entire state get to that 75% goal.
So when this becomes available to residents, what should they know? I mean, when they're sorting out their bins and all that stuff, I mean, just some kind of tangible bullet points to keep in mind when you're throwing stuff away.
Well, the first and foremost thing that I want everybody to know, Vicki, is that every time we take something that would have otherwise gone in the trash and we put it in an organic waste bin, we are fighting climate change. And I know that for a lot of people, that is key here in California. We just simply cannot afford to wait to fight climate change, and people want to know how that they can be a part of that solution. And by participating in programs where we are diverting our waste, we are doing that. So helping our food banks get more edible food to help serve our homeless population and our food insecure population is something big every Californian can do. And then throwing that banana peel in the green waste bin instead of their trash bin is a huge step.
So essentially just putting food scraps into a green waste bin. But do you put it into a bag, or should you actually remove the plastic bag?
never put plastic in your organic waste bin. We want to keep only organic things in those bins.
Yeah. Well, I guess with that, I mean, there's recycling sounds easy, but it can be confusing. I have to do Google searches every now and then, and you look at the number, you know, at the bottom of the plastic container. And I mean, even when you do Google, I mean, the autofill function brings up like so many suggestions. If you type like, can I recycle, you know, dot, dot, dot. What are some other ways CalRecycle is just making it easier for residents across the state to recycle more and to know what to put what in what bin?
Right, right. I think, you know, right now we're developing some new tools, educational tools to help Californians. We know that as materials have become more complicated and complex over recent years, that it's been harder for people to figure out best recycling techniques. So we are working on some educational tools to help with that. We're also working, and this is an initiative by Governor Newsom that I think is so incredibly important that was part of his budget this year. We are creating an Office of Innovation here at CalRecycle that is really going to be groundbreaking and helping build the circular economy here in California. And so we see as a real key part of our recovery here in California as building that circular economy that is going to bring those businesses to California that are going to help us recycle the consumer goods that we are using, but even more importantly, manufacturing them into things that can be used again. And so we think that partnership here at the state level with CalRecycle, with our local government partners, and then our private partners is going to be so key in helping Californians really truly achieve what they want to achieve in terms of reducing their impact on the planet. Mm.
Well, Rachel, thanks for joining us and helping us, you know, break down some of that information. A little bit of a pun there. So
I like it a lot, Vicky. Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. And anytime you want to talk again, I would love to do it.
Rachel Maki-Wagoner is the director for CalRecycle. Well, still ahead, we're going to head outside. We're going to get a tour of re-emerging gold rush towns thanks to the drought. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, by overwhelming estimates, the drought is just devastating to California. I mean, we talk about it regularly, and really, it can't be discussed enough, given the diversity of needs across the state. But there are also some interesting consequences that may be surprising. Low water levels are reminding us of California's framework as settlers began traveling west. Towns from more than a century ago are reemerging. The drought has brought Folsom Lake's waterline low enough to expose Gold Rush-era settlements under the lake. So to give us a tour, and also important advice if you do encounter one, is Devin Swartwood. He is an interpreter with California State Parks. Devin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
I think, Devin, just get the first thing out of the way. What exactly is an interpreter?
So an interpreter is, I like to say that I speak for the natural resources and the cultural resources of California. So, you know, I wear the Stetson hat. A lot of people think of rangers. It's an unbadged ranger. So in California, rangers are law enforcement. So you can think of it in those various ways.
Well, given that you are an interpreter, I believe you're level 2, correct?
Correct.
Great. Well, talking about the reduced water levels at the lake, I mean, we've all seen the photos and they're just so dramatic and striking. But, you know, people are even taking screenshots of their maps while at the lake's edge, showing that they're technically in the middle of the lake. You know, what's been exposed for people to actually explore?
So along the lake edge, there's an old gold rush town that's normally located under Folsom Lake. But as we mentioned, you know, California is experiencing a drought worsened by impacts of climate change. And the town that's emerging from the lake is called Red Bank. And that town, Gold Rush era town that was largely agriculture. So wine, grapes, things of that nature. And as people walk along the water's edge near the marina, you can see evidence of the town, historic foundations from some of the buildings that were there. And there's even items kind of scattered about sometimes, or even buried in the ground.
I imagine that must be really fun and interesting for you as well.
It is really fun and interesting. And actually, you know, we go out there often. There's staff out there right now, out there talking to visitors. And, you know, we do encourage that the people look around, but it is important to remember when you're exploring this area and actually any California State Park for that matter, that anything you find in a California State Park should stay in the park. So any items that you find if you're out at the lake need to stay there. We encourage people to look with their eyes, but again, everything you find in a state park should stay in a state park for everybody to enjoy, because California state parks are for everyone.
You know, given that, you know, we're looking at a Gold Rush era settlement that is now, you know, when we're not in a drought, underwater, what happened? What happened to this settlement? What were you able to learn?
Well, so the Folsom Lake is a man-made reservoir, and so when that reservoir was commissioned, the town was still there, Red Bank, and there's actually some other towns located further under the water that haven't emerged yet, like Mormon Island. And when the dam was commissioned, essentially those people had to leave their homes and the town was flooded. So that's kind of where it happened. It seems kind of odd to us, but you know, there's a lot of lakes, man-made reservoirs in California. There's others that also have sites, towns located under them. So people had to move and take their things, and the town was flooded in the 1950s when Folsom Dam was completed.
Yeah, you just mentioned Mormon Island. So these are two separate settlements, correct? That are, and Mormon Island is currently still under water, right, at Folsom Lake?
Correct. Yeah. And in previous years, there was a lot of news about Mormon Island, but it was just some confusion. There are two separate town sites, the Mormon Island and Red Bank. And yeah, currently what most people can see is Red Bank. The water would need to get a little bit lower for us to see Mormon Island.
When you're looking at kind of basically these like artifacts that are at the bottom of the lake, really exploring California's history, does it allow you and also just maybe other historians to learn more about the Gold Rush era in our state?
It definitely does. You know, the Folsom Lake area, a lot of it is owned by federal land, so the Bureau of Reclamation, and also state land, but it's all managed under a partnerships agreement by California State Parks. And so we have archaeologists from Bureau of Reclamation and also California State Parks. And there are an immense amount of things we can learn from these artifacts about the people that live there. And again, wasn't that long ago that it was flooded, 1950s, but there's still plenty we can learn from our past. And some of these artifacts can tell us different things. So again, that's part of the reason why we encourage people to leave them there, so that we can explore things and learn ourselves and then educate the visitors that come and that are curious about these things in the future. So yeah, artifacts are important. Again, when you see things out there or at any state park, it's important to just observe, learn, and leave it for others to enjoy, and so that we can all learn from it.
Finally, in the last, you know, 20, 30 seconds we have, I'm just curious, is the visitor center or is there any kind of discussion about collecting some of these items to put on display in a museum?
We don't normally do that. we currently don't have a museum per se specifically dedicated to the lake. We haven't necessarily discussed that yet. That would have to go over with our archaeologist and other staff members from the cultural side to discuss. But again, it's some of it's learn and put back to learn more later, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Thanks for the history lesson, Devin.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Devin Swartwood is an interpreter with California State Parks, explaining how the drought led to the reemergence of some gold rush towns at Folsom Lake. Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests and get a video tour of Folsom Lake gold rush towns at capradio.org/insight. You can also listen to the Insight podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.